even though it took us longer to get going.
So when you reflect on the growing strength of the movements around Occupy, the Occupy movements, can you talk a little about what the solutions are that people are putting forward? Because I think a lot of our listeners know about the economic system. They identify a lot of the same problems in the system that you do. But as an economist, what do you think some of the either incremental and then eventually long-term solutions are?
Well, I think they are, first, the Occupy movement is aware of a lot of the things I'm about to say. They discuss them. They have their what they call working groups that have taken these projects on in different cities, in different localities, in different ways. And there's a lot of debate about a whole host of things. But I am very heartened by the willingness to question capitalism as a system. That's stunning, more for the United States than anywhere else on Earth. And so I want to underscore all of that before saying what myself, what I think is the direction that has to go. Anyway, here is my sense of what I hope will happen and what I know some of the Occupy folks are already doing since I work with them and provide information and analysis for them. The first is what you yourself just called, or words to this effect, short-term, immediate demands, solutions that could be made. And there are several of those. The single most important one has to do with unemployment. I mean, that is the number one economic problem in the United States. No matter how rarely politicians are willing to talk about it, since fundamentally they have nothing to say about it, so they don't want to talk about it. It's what's forced on them, usually by popular polling or other mechanisms that make them understand it. Anyway, the problem is the following. We have had between 9 and 10% basically unemployment. And if you actually do the proper numbers, you use what's called the U6 number that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses. We're talking 15 to 16% of unemployment in the United States, people who have no job, people who have given up looking, and people who have part-time jobs but involuntarily because they want a full-time job. You're talking one out of six Americans. That's a disaster for our economy. It's also the case that these people are unemployed for longer periods of time than we have any record of in the history of this country. And the longer a person is unemployed, the more devastating the effects. You use up your savings, you become a burden on your friends and family and relatives and neighbors, you lose your skills, you lose your contacts. So the costs, the social costs of unemployment, which are enormous anyway, are even worse when they last a long time. And this unemployment has been in the 8.5, 9, 10% range for 3 years now. Nothing has been done. The Bush program, when he was president, was to stimulate and incentivize the private sector to hire people. Obama has said exactly the same thing. He said it as a campaigner. He said it as president. And the fact that for the last 3 years, the unemployment has remained at the same level, despite incentives and despite subsidies given to the private sector, would have led any person not in the pocket of big business to have realized that that program doesn't work and that another one would be necessary. But because both parties are in the pockets of the business community, who has no interest in solving this problem, no interest in solving it at its expense, or to allow any infringement on their freedoms, we don't have an adequate solution. So the first thing Occupy should do is point that out as strongly as possible, make people aware not only that this unemployment is the devastating burden on not just the people who are employed. The examples of the ramifications are countless. Unemployed people cannot maintain payments on their home. If they can't maintain payments on their home, then their homes deteriorate. They can't paint the house, and eventually they can't stay in the house. If you live next door to a person who can't maintain his, her house or stay in it, the value of your house goes down too. So the social costs of unemployment on all kinds of people beyond the unemployed and their immediate families is staggering. And it exceeds the cost, here comes the punchline, of almost any program that could be conceived. What Occupy ought to do, therefore, is say, the last time we had unemployment this bad, lasting this long, the 1930s, the president went on the radio, Roosevelt, and he said, if the private sector cannot or will not hire the people, then the federal government is going to do it. Between 1934 and 41, Roosevelt created and filled 12 million jobs. Today's population in the United States would be double that. And therefore, that would be a major solution to the unemployment problem. It's not a solution that comes from Russia or China or Cuba or any of the bugaboo places that people would like to dismiss. It's our own history that the current crop of Republican and Democratic leaders chooses to forget, never bring up, never provide, therefore, the faintest excuse why not to do today what was the necessary thing to do the last time we had a crisis of this sort. So the first thing Occupy ought to do is demand that. But that's only the first. If I have the time for the second, good. The second thing is to learn from the mistakes that were made. The reason Roosevelt had to provide public jobs was because he had a mass movement there. He had what Occupy is now trying to build, a powerful CIO that organized more workers in the 1930s than any union wave in America had ever organized before or ever organized since. Millions of people joined unions. You had a powerful set of socialist parties with large memberships and a powerful communist party with large membership and lots of overlap between the socialist party and the unions and the communist party and the unions so that they could work together, a dense network of people. And they forced that Roosevelt to change. But notwithstanding that, they made a colossal mistake. And Occupy has to learn. This is the most crucial thing to get across. They have to learn from the mistake. What was the mistake? You imposed on the business community and on the rich regulations and taxes. Regulations to try to prevent another great crisis, and taxes to pay for hiring those millions of people. Someone had to pay for those workers to build the national parks and build the highways and build, if I'm not mistaken, the Golden Gate Bridge, among other things. So when you did that, when you went after the wealthy and the businesses to tax them, to pay them, pay for this solution, and to regulate the system, you made their boards of directors and their shareholders the enemy of all of this because you were hurting their profits. You were taxing their wealth. You were regulating their ability to make money. And so what they did, as soon as they were able, which was usually before the ink was dry on the bills that raised the taxes and imposed the regulations, they went to work to undo the New Deal that had been imposed on them. And the mistake of the movements then was to leave them in a position to do it, to let them gather into their hands the profits of our society, the wealth we create year in and year out, the difference between the value of what we all as workers produce and what we get as wages and salary. That profit they used to undo the regulations, to reduce the taxes, in order to recreate for themselves the situation they were angry at having been deprived of. The great reform movements of the 1930s never touched the capacity of the business community to hold on to the wealth and to use it to undo the New Deal. So what Occupy has to learn now, one lesson, reproduce the movements of the 30s that won the reforms. Second lesson, don't stop at reform, because if you do, you will simply set in motion the undoing of whatever it is we achieve this time, just as the movements of the 30s set in motion the conditions that make us now have taxes one-third of what they were in the 1940s, regulations that have completely disappeared. For example, the Banking Act, the Glass-Steagall Act, imposed on banks in the 30s, was undone by the late 1990s, signed by President Clinton in 1999. 8 years later, the banking system collapses again. It's like a joke. And so Occupy has to take the bite, take the courage. You cannot leave in place the classic capitalist enterprise controlled by the major shareholders and the boards of directors, because they will do what they have done. Take the money they keep drawing into their hands, use the wealth of this society to undo every reform, every tax imposed on them, until we're back again in an economic system making a lot of money for them and crisis for everybody else. That's where we were in 1929.
So I'm going to push you to take a little further. If the idea is to have taxation, regulation, and to somehow prevent them from rolling those things back, what's the recipe for preventing this rollback? What are the elements of that?
Okay. Here's how we would do it. first we have to face what we're saying, and I want to be clear, no shying away, no drawing back. We're going to change. We need to change the organization of production, the way enterprises are organized. No more you and I come to work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and then we go home at the end of the day or the week, and we leave behind everything we produced. What we poured our mental and physical capabilities into producing belongs instantaneously to someone else. That's got to stop. It's got to be the mass of people who dispose of the wealth they create so it cannot be used to create a 1%, 99% dichotomy, cannot be used to undo the reforms we worked so hard to put into place to protect ourselves. So it's very clear we have to change the organization of production.
But, Rick, people would say, oh, my God, you're pie in the sky. You're talking about collective workplaces. You're talking about
exactly.
Total transformation. Help people to bridge where we are now and this wonderful – it's an attractive vision. But I'm just playing devil's advocate here and saying, how do you get there?
Let me tell you. Here's the way you institutionalize it. We now have, depending on how you count, 20 to 25 million people without work or without the kind of work that they want. That's one-fifth of our total labor force in this country. So we're talking about a major chunk. What we need and what I would hope Occupy demands is a federal employment program, but radically different from what was in the 1930s. Here's the demand. The government will provide the capital and the technical assistance for these 25 million people to go back to work in enterprises that they themselves control. And let me give you an example of how practical this is. And the best way I know how to do that is to give you the name of a law in a country which already does it. In Italy, right now, there's a law. I believe it's called the Marcona Law, but it may be a slightly different name, named after the legislator who pushed it through. It's been on the books in Italy for at least 20 years. And here's what it does. If you are unemployed in Italy, you have a choice. You can either get on the dole the way we do here in this country. You get so much money per week, depending on the job you had before, for so and many weeks to see you through the unemployment time. Or, in Italy, you get a choice. The government will give you 3 years' worth of your weekly unemployment payments up front in a lump on the following conditions. You must get, I believe it's at least eight other workers, eight or more, to make the same, unemployed, make the same choice you do. Each of them will get the upfront money on condition that you begin and operate a collective enterprise on your own. And the stick, if you like, together with the carrot, is this. If the enterprise goes belly up, you don't get any unemployment. This is your unemployment. So you're going to see a dozen workers, two dozen, 100, 200, getting together, working as hard as they can because this is their own future. This is their long-term and short-term. This is their solution. And it has worked very well in Italy. And I think here in the United States it would work because here's what would happen. We would have, for the first time in America, a real choice for workers between a top-down, old-style capitalist enterprise and these millions of people forming the other kind of enterprise with government support and government money up front as an alternative to the old unemployment system. We would allow people to be able to go into a store and buy a product that had on its label not just the country from which it came, and maybe not even just the fair trade it might have come through, but for the first time the labels will be required to say, this business was made in a capitalist enterprise, this business was made in an enterprise where the workers are their own bosses. And I got a news for you. Every poll of the American people taken in the last 50 years says that the American people would love to be able to buy goods that were produced by workers who were their own bosses, since the overwhelming majority of American workers want to be their own bosses.
But when you say there's popular support for this, and polls show that people want to be their own bosses, there is the element of class consciousness, of understanding that it's actually a little bit more than just running your own business. It is the structural issues you were talking about earlier as far as the capitalist system, because if they just recreate the same profit model, then it's kind of another way to the same end that you find problematic. So I guess my question is, maybe you can break down the barriers to class consciousness in the U.S. if you think that's a precursor to this new types of formation made in the USA by armies of unemployed, right? Maybe there's some historical or international examples you can give of how movements have helped to stimulate and highlight and develop this way of thinking, because there's a mental shift that happens, not just the pragmatism of, I need a job, I'm getting money to go set up a collective. There's a little bit more in a shift of consciousness, and I think some people have identified the need for class consciousness as sort of part of this recipe. So let me rephrase it. It's a shorter question. How did you let you ended up with? Oh, I had a great segue from where you started.
I was stressing that people would support this.
Right. Like this. So since you're saying polls show that people want to be their own bosses, what are the other mental shifts that people need to do around their understanding of these systems and class consciousness? How do you see that fitting in?
The way I answer that when it comes up in my talks is to be as practical and concrete as I know how in my answers. And rather to articulate an abstract principle, to give a concrete example. And here's how it would go. And this would come, for example, easily out of the Occupy 1%, 99%. I would explain that if workers ran their own enterprises, here's what they would never do. They would never give managers, even the top managers in their enterprise, on average, 350 times the average wage of the worker. That would never happen if workers made these decisions collectively. And that's the single most important decision that shapes the gap between the 99% and the 1%. So if you're concerned about inequality of income in this country, as the polls show the majority of Americans are, then here is a concrete way to finally do something about it. By changing the organization of the enterprise, you put the decision makers as the mass of people, and they would never articulate, they would never support, they would never continue a level of inequality, anything like what we have in the United States today. We even have examples in places like Mondragon in Spain, where there are workers who make these decisions. The average rate is between 8 and 10 times is the gap between the highest paid worker at the top of a hierarchy and everybody else. And even that is disputed, but nothing remotely like what we have in the United States. So if you want a movement towards equality, this kind of transformation of the enterprise is a concrete step. And I don't know of any other movement in this country that articulates any other way, halfway as practical as this one, to get what they even claim they want in the way of greater equality. But there's more. If workers made the decisions collectively, they wouldn't move the factories to China. I hate to be blunt about this, but the whole exodus of enterprise out of the United States would come to a massive grinding halt. Now, that would incur all kinds of costs and problems. Of course it would. Just like what we do now, which is allow them to leave, costs us massively as a society. And we would have to work on that. But if that's a concern, the loss of jobs and the loss, therefore, of the bargaining power of working people because there aren't the jobs and therefore there's not the need for them, then one way to handle this is to stop the movement of jobs because workers are not going to eradicate their own employment. And finally, another example. An awful lot of people are concerned about the destruction of the environment, whether it's the air, the water, etc. Well, we have a situation in which the single most important pollution in our society has to do with how we organize production, whether it's what comes out of the smokestack of a factory, whether it's what comes out of what cleanser is used to keep the toilets clean, whatever it is. Well, the problem is, in most cases, that the decision what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, is made by a board of directors, 10 or 15 people, selected by major shareholders, another 10 or 15 people, who sit often thousands of miles away and who make the decision what you're going to use in your enterprise All that's gone if the workers themselves are making these decisions, because they and their husbands and their wives and their children and their neighbors are going to have to breathe what goes on in that factory, live with the consequences. If you want to make a major move in the direction of a green United States, a greening of our disastrous interaction with nature, then put the people who have to live with the consequences in the decision-making position. I mean, democracy calls for no less anyway, but here are three practical ways: drastically reduce the inequality of income and therefore wealth, drastically stop the destruction of our unions and our working people by the exodus of jobs, and drastically reorganize the production process in the interest of a better relationship with nature. All of those could be given quantum steps forward by this change. And I think because people support a narrowing inequality, people support keeping jobs here, and people support an environmentally successful program, we can teach the American people that this transformation beyond capitalism is the way to move forward in those areas where their support is already assured.
It strikes me that in those three areas you've outlined, there's a scale issue. And again, devil's advocate, naysayers Please. Would say that kind of decentralized and small-scale localized solutions and localized worker control production, it's not possible in the U.S. So how do you respond to that?
Every system that has ever existed in the human race in the way of producing goods and service, in other words, any economic system, has always had this kind of problem to solve. Let me remind you, nothing is more central to the history of the United States and its capitalist system, to its successes and its failures, to its bloodbaths as well as to its achievements, then the continuing struggle from the beginning to this moment between big business and small business. Little businesses are bitterly complaining all the time that big business destroys their ability to function, imposes on them absurd costs, that, you know, in every community in America over the last 30 years, the great anxiety of every storekeeper is the arrival of the Walmart store, which is going to wipe them out, destroy all their relationships, take away from local people the ability to have credit when they need it because they know the local shop. You know the story because it's part of our folklore of American history. So when people say to me, gee, there's going to be a problem of how little companies get to get, that's always a problem. And you're absolutely right. When workers run their own enterprises, if the enterprises is got 50 people in it, it's in a different social situation from an enterprise that has 5,000 people in it. Enterprise that is only existing in one locale will have different set of problems from an enterprise that has units in 10 locales, especially if they're far away and have different sizes. Those problems have to be worked out, and they will be worked out. The difference is the relationship among the enterprises on the one hand and between them and the public that buys the output on the other will be mediated by democratically run enterprises who are going to have to work this out in ways that are consistent with democracy, because that's what they are. The reason we don't have a democratic solution to those problems now is that the agent at the center who makes the decisions is the modern capitalist corporation, which is a fundamentally undemocratic system, since the majority of people who depend on the corporation, its employees number one and its customers number two, are not the decision makers. The decision makers are a tiny group of people who own the shares and who sit on the board of directors. And that means they make decisions about how big business and small business interact, the scale of decisions, the scale of business. They make those decisions in order to reproduce their capitalist system. We would make it in order to reproduce a democratically organized workplace, and that would be all the difference in the world.